All right, Confession of Faith, Chapter 23, The Civil Magistrate. We're up to Section 4. It is the duty of people to pray for magistrates, to honor their persons, to pay them tribute and other dues, to obey their lawful commands, and to be subject to their authority for conscience' sake. Infidelity or difference in religion doth not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from their due obedience to him, from which ecclesiastical persons are not exempted, much less hath the Pope any power and jurisdiction over them in their dominions, or over any of their people, and least of all to deprive them of their dominions or lives, if he shall judge them to be heretics, or upon any other pretense whatsoever. I'm going to talk about a few things today. And this is really going to wrap up our discussion of the magistrate with respect to what the confession has to say on this matter. We're going to talk about a lot of this as it is, in fact, preceptive. Not always going to be getting into the question of whether or not this or that particular claim is, in fact, a legitimate claim to be a magistrate or the magistrate to which we owe all of the things that are talked about here. Nonetheless, there are reasons for the inclusion of each of these different sentences in this section. The concern had to do with certain errors in the Anabaptists, certain positions of the Papists. So we need to remember that they're steering between two very sharp rocks upon which the ship of state could be dashed. They are, in fact, prescribing and have been prescribing the parameters of legitimate government, the kind of government to which we can yield subjection for conscience' sake. So we're going to talk first about the duty of the people to pray for magistrates and honor their persons, and some of the reasons why. We will discuss some things along the way. I'm sure it'll come up, the areas where, as covenanters, we need to be very careful about how we approach this section. This section was, in fact, often quoted to the covenanters right before they subjected them to a sentence of death and moved them along to be executed. All right, so we're going to deal with the duty of the people in general with respect to lawful magistracy. We're going to talk about that provision of that is in here. Does infidelity or difference of religion make void the magistrate's just and legal authority? And we'll talk about why that is there a little bit. That's an important statement that's there, but it's there. It has a very good reason for being there. And we're going to explain that basically in terms of that were embraced by the martyrs as they, in fact, confess their adherence to this section with certain provisos. Finally, we're going to examine the claims of the papists in the second part that ecclesiastical persons are exempted from civil jurisdiction. That is very problematic. That is something which I think we need to discuss and consider what happens when the church, any church, is elevated above this disobedience to lawful magistracy. That's exactly where that's exactly where we find popery positioning itself in the world. So we need to discuss that, and then there's this corollary to it, which goes something like this. Because they are exempted on the one hand, they can't be subject to civil, any kind of civil action. On the other hand, they make a claim, the papists make a claim to have jurisdiction over all nations. And that constitutes the formal principle upon which popery must be rejected as anti-Christian. So again, this is an interesting point. It's really, in a sense, setting us up for a couple of things, certain statements which are made in the next chapter on marriage and divorce, and then in chapter 25, when we talk about the church, we've already, by this point now in the confession, established some very important things regarding the claims of popery. Things which should help us understand why it was very easy to move from rejecting these claims to rejecting the papacy altogether as Antichrist. So we're going to be looking at this, but we need to keep in mind, on the one hand, we've got all of those Anabaptist types on the left of us who want to dismiss the idea of lawful magistracy altogether. All right, they are, when it comes to civil magistracy, they're anarchists. And that is ungodly and anti-Christian altogether. On the other hand, we have to our right papists who don't dismiss magistratical authority, but they do want to subject all of that to their own power and jurisdiction. So that has to be avoided as well. So those are the two extremes, and this section of the confession is oscillating between answering both of these extremes. So the first question then: is it the duty of people to pray for magistrates and honor their persons? The answer is yes. Look at 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, and 1 Peter 2, 17.
1 Timothy 2, verses 1 and 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty.
1 Peter 2:17, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king.
Yeah, so there's a general command amongst the apostles regarding this duty of the people to pray for magistrates, to honor their persons. Thus, we can say there are some who err, who deny this. First of all, because Samuel, at the request of Saul, whom he knew the Lord had rejected, returned again after him and honored him before the people. 1 Samuel 15, verse 31.
So Samuel turned again after Saul, and Saul worshipped the Lord.
Yeah, and this This, of course, might require a little bit of explanation. Samuel returns because although Saul has been rejected by God, the sentence has not yet been executed. In other words, David has not yet been brought to power. And until that transition is made, it's a sentence that remains to be enforced. And until God enforces it in Israel, Saul remains the legitimate magistrate.
Was there something peculiar about the kings in Israel, particularly in this time period? Because there were examples, weren't there, where there was like particular credence given, like when David's fleeing Saul, that this is the anointed of the Lord. And didn't David execute some people who wanted
to... You have to understand that the kingship in Israel was established by God, and it literally, this is a problem, and we'll talk about this in another context, but at no time were the kings in the northern kingdom actually legitimate or lawful authorities. Mm. All right? You never have a good king in the north. Okay? In the south, you have good kings and you have bad kings. But the constitution of government in the south is legitimate. And so it has to be observed. And that begins with Saul. You know, even when there's this transfer to the house of David, and then it must remain with David, it must remain with David once the transfer has been made. But until that transfer has been made, the legitimate constitution remains with Saul. So it doesn't... We have to remember that the issue is not whether or not this or that person is a sinner, or if they've sinned or if they've done evil things. That in and of itself is not grounds for rejecting legitimacy and magistracy. All right? It has to do with the constitution that lies behind it. Now, when a legitimately constituted government or authority does something contrary to the word of God, then, you know, as we are in all cases where we're being commanded, whether it's a legitimate or illegitimate exercise, we're to obey God rather than men. So a legitimate constitution doesn't allow us out from under that. But an illegitimate constitution, as we should understand here, it cannot commend itself to a conscientious subjection. Right, so what's going on here with Saul is, yes, he's a wicked man. He's shown himself to be a wicked man and unfaithful. But he hasn't yet been impeached. Well, he's been impeached, let's say, but he hasn't been removed from office. Right? The indictment has been read. The sentence has been declared. But the actual removal hasn't happened. And so until that happens, there is, in fact, a legitimate ordinance here. All right, second. Because the Lord, having appointed magistrates to administer justice and judgment in his name, is so far pleased to honor them as to call them gods and the children of the Most High. It's Psalm 82, 1 and 6.
Psalm 82, verse 1. God standeth in the congregation of the mighty. He judgeth among the gods. In verse 6. I have said, ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High.
I said that you're gods, all of you are children of the Most High. the language that is used that tells us that when we have a legitimate exercise, legitimate administration, then God has appointed it, and they're to be honored as such. Third, because the Apostle Peter says, fear God and honor the king, parallel to what Paul says when he says, render to all men their dues, honor to whom honor is due. 1 Peter 2:17 again, compared with Romans 13:7.
1 Peter 2, verse 17, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king.
Romans 13:7, render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor.
Yeah, and again, you have to remember, this is section 4 of the confession. We've already established that what we're talking about is a magistrate which is of God, that it is a legitimate authority which flows from God, which is conformed to the law of God, whether that law be the law of nature or for nations that have the light of special revelation, the light of Scripture. But when it's constituted in that fashion, it is an institution of God. And as an institution of God, there is an obligation of all men to yield them that obedience. Right, fourth, because even heathen magistrates are called the Lord's anointed. Okay. Isaiah 45:1,
thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut.
Yeah, so Cyrus is actually called the anointed, or a Christ. Why? Because in a certain manner, here he is being made to typify magistrates yielding their and wielding their power on behalf of Messiah. And so in this particular, when heathen magistrates behave themselves in this way, then they are in fact entitled to a due recognition and honor in that respect. Now, does that mean that they're always constituted in this way that we're concerned about? No.
Would that mean that if, say, Obama, well, Trump now, if they came here, would we be required to call him Mr. President?
I wouldn't do that. Call him Mr. Obama or Mr. Trump. I would avoid giving any, you know, giving any sense of lending any credence to legitimacy.
But if it was a nation without the light of the gospel, would you be required to give them the title of their magisterial office? Because they don't
sometimes
have that light of nature? I mean,
sometimes.
That's all they're working on? Okay.
You know, when they're behaving in a manner that is conformable to that, yes.
Okay.
And that's the point here. The Lord calls Nebuchadnezzar his servant as well in Jeremiah 27:6.
Jeremiah 27:6. And now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beasts of the field have I given him also to serve him.
Yeah, so then such magistrates ought to be honored upon that account, much more Christian magistrates. And that's really what you have to remember. The Westminster Divines and those who are writing and interacting at this point, they're really dealing with men who profess to be Christians. Maybe not sound Christians, but Christians. Maybe not faithful Christians, but nonetheless Christians. And they have, all of them, have some sense of obligation to God and even to Christ. And fifth, because we are obliged not to speak evil of dignity. 2 Peter 2:10.
2 Peter 2, verse 10. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government,
Presumptuous are they, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignities.
Again, nor revile the gods, by which we were talking about the civil rulers, the judges. Exodus 22:28.
Exodus 22:28. Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people.
Right. We're obliged to honor dignities, for where sin is forbidden, the contrary duty is commanded. And that, as we'll see later. When I discuss Romans 13:2, that works the other way as well. That principle. So you know when they're not conducting themselves as the ordinance of God, when they don't display this legitimacy, the opposite is our duty. If obedience is our duty to lawful administrations, disobedience is our duty to unlawful administrations and to unlawful commands. It's, you know, it works in the other direction, too. And we shouldn't forget that. All right? So, again, we need to ask whether or not these are really dignities, whether or not these are really the gods. Right? Before we bind our consciences to these commands. Because if they're not, actually, we're actually being required to do the opposite. Right? That's something to keep in mind. Okay? But let's remember the problem that's set before the reformers at this time. You had a lot of governments in Europe at this point who were professed Christian. They were Lutheran or Reformed. They were In some, they were Protestant, they were Reformed or Reforming. They were not heretical, they were certainly not Popish. And you had all these Anabaptists who were basically disavowing any allegiance or any subjection to these governments and causing insurrection and undermining the Reformation. So, you know, these were not people who were stirring up trouble or resisting an unlawful administration. And these are people who are resisting lawful administrations. That's why there's so much talk about this, in not only in our confession, but in a lot of the writings of the reformers. And we need to remember that. We need to remember the context in which they're writing and who it is that they're primarily addressing and the kind of governments that they have over them, which are usually nominally Christian, if not explicitly Christian, like at Geneva.
Now, you take that to where we are today. Obviously, the anarchists fall under that. But would libertarians fall under that as well? Under that kind of Anabaptistic...
Yeah, a lot of them.
Okay.
Yeah, that anarcho-capitalist wing of libertarianism. They're no better than Anabaptists when it comes to this point. The problem is that they conflate the ends. You know, the ends sometimes that they're calling for are legitimate given the illegitimate constitution of government that we're dealing with. But what they're rejecting is not an illegitimate constitution of government. They're rejecting the whole notion that there can even be a lawful administration of a higher authority. That's entirely contrary to the Bible. It's entirely contrary to what men know to be necessary by light of nature. So, you know, it's an unnatural, just from the standpoint, forget the Bible for a moment, it's unnatural. It's an unnatural position. You know, it's the political equivalent of advocating sodomy. And that's not what we're doing. Right. I think the Covenanters have been very very precise about drawing out the implications of this doctrine and not jumping to extremes. They've never jumped to the extreme of the Anabaptists on the one hand. They certainly haven't jumped toward the Papists.
So would you say Ron Paul's an Anabaptist then?
Yes, he is. He's a Baptist. He's a Baptist. Yeah. Sure. There's a reason for that. I don't think his brother, the Lutheran pastor, is actually in agreement with him on some of that stuff, by the way. All right, six, because God commanded his people, the Jews, to seek the peace of the city, which was Babylon, whither he caused them to be carried captives. Jeremiah 29:7.
Jeremiah 29:7, and seek the peace of the city whither I have caused you to be carried away captives, and pray unto the Lord for it, for the peace thereof shall ye have peace.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is notable for a number of reasons. God actually tells them to do this in this case. He doesn't always tell them to behave themselves, but in this case he does. And so you can see that there are situations and there are constitutions of government, even among the heathen, that are legitimate at some level. And, that needs to be recognized. Seven, because the prophet, the man of God, besought the Lord on behalf of Jeroboam and prayed for him, a man that had made apostasy from the true worship of God and made Israel to sin. 1 Kings 13:3-6.
1 Kings 13:3. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, "This is the sign which the Lord hath spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out." And verse 6, "And the king answered and said unto the man of God, Entreat now the face of the Lord thy God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought the Lord, and the king's hand was restored him again, and became as it was before."
Now Jeroboam was the king of Judah, correct?
No.
No?
He was king of Israel. He's in the northern kingdom. And they had made apostasy to the true worship of God.
So then why would he pray for him then if he is...
He's praying for...
Oh, okay.
He's praying for Jeroboam as he exists. He's in a position of power and authority over the people of God. He prays for him, but he's not praying for... He couldn't be praying for the continued constitution of the northern kingdom without praying that Israel would remain divided. Right. But praying that this would happen, you know, the hope is here that Jeroboam comes to recognize the error of his ways and that all this rebellion folds.
So we should always be praying at least for the reformation of any and every king.
Yes.
But we can't always pray for their well-being unless they're lawfully constituted.
We can't pray for their well-being apart from them actually being Christian.
Okay. True.
Right. So when they're in opposition, and we can't pray for their prosperity when they're, you know, they're persecuting the church or they're, you know, advancing an agenda contrary to true religion. So he's not praying for Jeroboam that he's going to prosper. He's not praying that the kingdom of Israel is going to prosper. He's praying specifically that Jeroboam would have his hand restored. Because what he's seeking ultimately is the spiritual well-being of Jeroboam. You know, we can't always pray for them as magistrates, but we ought always to pray for them because they are in that, they are functioning in that office. But if they're unbelievers, particularly when they're hostile to the moral precepts of God, they're going to function in that office to the detriment of true religion. We need to be very careful about how we pray for those who are exercising unlawful constitutions and so on, you know, and how much recognition we give and what kind of recognition we give. You know, to acknowledge that they have the power, the force to destroy you, that's a legitimate acknowledgement because they do. They have the guns. Right, they have the means to destroy your life, to take all of your stuff. But to recognize them as the ordinance of God in that usurpation, that's something else entirely. Okay. We're allowed to recognize them, in the reality of their possession, but we're not allowed to recognize that that is the ordinance of God. If they ask us to do that, we can't.
So we can recognize their providential rule, but not their preceptive rule.
Right. We can recognize that, yeah, you've got all the guns, and you've got all the power, and you can step on whoever and kill them. That doesn't mean that you have the right to do that. And if you demand of me a recognition that you have the right or the authority from God to behave in this way or to continue in this unlawful constitution, my answer is going to be no. It'll always be no. And wherever the need arises, I'm going to have to resist. Right? That's, we ought to obey God rather than men. Right, 8, because Christ says, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, Matthew 22:21.
Matthew 22:21. They say unto him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's.
Now, that truism, of course, doesn't settle, what is Caesar's and what is God's. There's a whole lot more we have to think about here. You can't just walk away from this and think that, the question has been resolved, because people who asked the question didn't walk away thinking that. They were still wondering what Jesus meant by that. Nonetheless, Jesus does say there are some things that belong to Caesar. There are things which pertain to the state justly. Does it pertain to every state or any state? No. Not justly. But to a lawful constitution and institution of God, yes. Justly. That doesn't, again, it doesn't mean that there aren't reasons why you yield certain compliances to the demands which are backed by just raw force. If it's something, you've got to ask yourself a lot of times, is this something that is making an incursion into the realm of true religion or not? Have they actually moved from something where, it's something that I have power over my own things to dispose of them? Okay, well, I'm allowed to pay the bribe. I'm allowed to dispose of my goods with respect to anyone. Whether or not it's a lawful administration of authority, I have the right and even the obligation to dispose of my goods as I believe to be most proper in that setting. But when it's an unlawful administration, it becomes even more important that I exercise wisdom, because at some point I'm going to have to ask this question, is what they're asking actually something designed to invade, not something over which, my goods, but now they're asking me to give something to them which actually belongs to God. That's why these guys are hung up on what Jesus says, because it really, if you stop and think about it, he's presented them with the horns of an awful dilemma. And they've got to begin to ask themselves, have I been giving actually what belongs to God to Caesar? It's not just the other way around. See, we've been so indoctrinated in statism, heathen statism, that we only tend to think about, we should give what belongs to Caesar, as if they were keeping back something for God that belonged to Caesar. Much more likely, the problem here is they were retaining or they were giving to Caesar what actually belonged to God. And that's why the Jews were in this situation they found themselves in, being in subjection to the Roman authority. Right. But, again, prayers and supplications are as due to Caesar's custom and tribute. 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2.
1 Timothy 2, verses 1 and 2. I exhort, therefore, that, first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty.
Yeah, so, you know, again, we should pray for them, but we have to pray for them as we have reason to believe them to be, either lawful or unlawful. And we need to be careful that we're not praying for the upbuilding of the kingdom of God on the one hand and the tearing down of the kingdom of God on the other hand by praying that an unlawful administration is allowed to be sustained in the providence of God, that it continues and persecutes and undermines the true religion, and so on. Right. The same with custom and tribute, by the way. I don't want to deal with that a lot right now. Does a lawful administration of authority have the right to exact custom and tribute? Yes. All right. Does that same right pertain to a usurpation? Of course not. Now, what do you do when you're faced with guns? Well, again, if it's something which is purely a matter that pertains to you, it's your stuff, it's your goods, you have the right to ransom your life. You have the right to give money for the price of your soul. Okay, but the moment that customer tribute begins to cross over, as it did with the Covenanters, for example, in the matter of the cess, which was a tax exacted for bearing down on the preaching of the gospel, then you can't give it. Right? You can't allow yourself to pay that kind of taxation. So if they, you know, it's like it today, if they had a tax, it was called the abortion tax, and you paid it, you would be complicit. You would be liable to the judgment of paying. You wouldn't be able to pay it. Right? Or they just name any kind of specific tax or fine, or, you know, it could be a fine that they're going to exact, and they're going to give, you know, if you're fined because you won't make a cake for a couple of sodomites, and they're going to fine you in order to give that money to the sodomites, you can't do it. You can't pay it. You know, you've got to be careful. There are lines.
Okay. Was the early church wrong in giving themselves up to being martyrs so quickly? Did they fight back at all in the early church? Or was it...
A lot of times they would flee.
Okay.
I mean, The first thing you should do is retreat. You know, that's really the first. You shouldn't be provocative, and you shouldn't be trying to engage them. But when you're cornered by them, and the only thing you can do is fight or just yield, well, then you fight. Right, but when you're captured, like when Renick was captured, immediately stopped fighting, because that would be giving them an excuse to break the sixth commandment in another fashion by beating him and harming, causing additional bodily harm. That also is not something you should do. So, you know, you can fight like a badger until they catch you, and then you know, at that point, it's better to submit to the providence of the situation. But that said, again, if you have an opportunity to break out of jail, the Covenanters had no problem with breaking people out of jail. Right. So, well, you know, these were not big proponents of a doctrine of passive obedience, nor did they think every constitution or institution of government was legit. They understood that a lot of this is not really legitimate. And they wouldn't pray for the king as king. They prayed for the king as a man, but they wouldn't pray for him as king. That would be to acknowledge an unlawful authority there. They would be acknowledging an unlawful authority as legitimate. All right, 9. Because the apostle commands us to pray for all in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life, which is a cause wherefore we must pray for magistrates. In the apostles' time and long after, magistrates were persecutors of the Church of God and hindered the members of Christ to live in peace and godliness. 1 Timothy 2:1-2 again.
1 Timothy 2:1-2, I exhort therefore that first of all supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty.
Right. So that, you know, again, that being the case, they're being hindered, they're hindering, you know, why are we praying for them? Well, we're praying for them that they'll leave the church alone, right? Well, we're not praying that they're going to prosper in their persecution, or that their government will have no end, or that they'll, you know, they'll have great success in undermining true religion. You know, should we pray that they're converted? Sure. Should we pray that they recognize that they're involved in a usurpation? Absolutely. But should we declare them lawful authorities? Well, I would think not. 10, because Moses cried unto the Lord on behalf of Pharaoh, Exodus 8:12.
Exodus 8:12, and Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried unto the Lord because of the frogs which he had brought against Pharaoh.
Abram prayed for Abimelech, Genesis 20:17.
Genesis 20:17. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children.
Jacob blessed Pharaoh, Genesis 47:7-10.
Genesis 47:7. And Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And verse 10, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh.
Yeah, so again, how are they reacting? Well, they're acknowledging the reality. I mean, this is not, you know, the Bible is not telling us to ignore the reality. These people are in power providentially. We have to deal with that. And we need to pray for them as people who possess power. But that doesn't mean we have to own that as a legitimate exercise of authority. Those are two different things. You know, recognizing the reality of something is one thing. Saying that what is what ought to be is something altogether different. And we're not being called to do that here. The problem is, and the reason, again, why this is in our confession is you have a group of people. They were quite large at the time of the Reformation, Anabaptists, who many of them reject any kind of authority in under any consideration. You know, they cast off authority that they thought was all authority. They didn't even ask whether or not it was legitimate or illegitimate administration or exercise, or whether or not it was the institution of God. They rejected all. And they wouldn't pray for them. They just simply... they treated them all with one stroke, and that you couldn't, if you're an Anabaptist, in most Anabaptist groups to this day, would say if you're an Anabaptist, you cannot hold, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago, can't hold political office. It's inconsistent with being Christian. Well, this is because they have a number of ideas about why there's civil magistracy, whether or not you know it you can wage war. They tend to be doctrinaire pacifists. They don't hold to a position wherein they could imagine a just war. And 11, because many blessed martyrs going to death have prayed for the persecuting magistrates, following the example and command of Christ. Luke 23:34 and Matthew 5:44.
Luke 23:34. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots.
Matthew 5:44. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you.
Yeah, again and again, I would just say that does not mean you're acknowledging legitimacy, right, in what they're doing. That would be to condone, for example, murder.
Anytime the church is being persecuted, is that grounds for a just war against that persecuting magistrate? If the Christians got together and fought?
The Christians generally, the martyrs are defensive. They're defensive in their arms. They're not offensive. Is it ground for defensive arms? Always.
Doesn't some defense involve a little bit of offense as well?
Yeah, you're not, no. Not really.
So if the king was killing Christians and you know the Christians gathered together, wouldn't you want to go right to the capital and kill the king, who's the queen bee, who's commanding all the other bees to do what they're saying? Isn't that in a way like you're being defensive there, but you're also being offensive, because in order to have a proper defense, you have to attack.
Yeah, and that's sort of a different question that has to do with executing extraordinary judgment or justice. It's not particularly. You're talking about an individual. You're not talking about conducting a war per se.
Okay.
We're not talking about an offensive war. We're talking about carrying out extraordinary justice. That's a different question, and the short answer to that is yes, it is biblical, it is allowable, and it's a very difficult topic, and a lot of people today would have a very hard time with this idea. Nonetheless, the Covenanters, particularly after the killing of Archbishop Sharp, all the Covenanter martyrs, almost to a man and woman, they acknowledged that was a just exercise of judgment against someone who is a notorious enemy, who had shed a lot of blood, and who had been not just tolerated but nurtured by the present unlawful administration of government. So there are a lot of things that go into that, but yes. All right, question two. Does infidelity or difference of religion make void the magistrate's just and legal authority? Or does it free the people from their due obedience to him? The answer is no. Again, 1 Peter 2:13, Romans 13:1-4, and Titus 3:1.
1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme.
Romans 13:1-4. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil.
Titus 3:1. put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready to every good work.
Okay. Thus the papists, Anabaptists, and others are maintaining that subjects ought not to suffer a king that is an infidel or obey a king in his just commands that differs from them in religion. This is, I'm going to talk about the reasons in just a moment that that we can give. But this is a very difficult question. And there are a couple things to point out here. The first is, the papists in particular said that if you weren't a papist, they released all papists from obedience to non-papist kings. Even their just and legal commands. Okay, things where they're telling them to do only what's right. Now, a lot of times people view this as just a one-way discussion in our confession. It's actually, it can be considered and should be considered in a couple of ways. First of all, infidelity or difference of religion, when we talk about just and legal authority, okay, we can't be talking, in the case of Britain, it wouldn't be just and legal authority if you were an infidel or of a different religion, right? Because the constitution of the country prohibited someone who was an infidel or of different religion from holding power. Okay, so you can't just take that out of context. And that's what the prelates tried to do with the Covenanters during the killing times. And they denied, first of all, that there was a just and legal authority, particularly when they ended up with James II, who was a papist. That's one consideration. Second consideration is that in no way, as Rennick points out, he says, you know, we cheerfully subscribe to the article of our Confession of Faith, chapter 23, section 4, that infidelity or difference in religion does not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from the due obedience to him. But we think it no way inconsistent wherewith to say with Naphtali, which is an apologetic for the Covenanters, let the words be considered, and we're confident that no sober man will think the acknowledgement of just and legal authority and due obedience a rational ground to infer that tyranny is thereby either allowed or privileged. Now, in addition to that, you can also understand it's not going to excuse you from obedience to a Christian magistrate because you're an infidel or of different religion, like the Anabaptists. So it really, this is a two-way street here. When there is a just and legal constitution, provided the magistrate is in fact ruling and reigning in accordance with the precepts of God, either law of nature, if they don't have scripture, or when they have the light of the gospel, it really needs to be the Bible. Provided they're ruling and reigning in accordance with that, and the government itself is constituted in accordance with that, you know, their personal infidelity or difference of religion is almost immaterial. Now, that's a little bit different when they're required to take a covenant. You know, then they're at least outwardly professing. Still don't know the heart. But just, you see, the Anabaptists just assumed that anyone who was maintaining civil office couldn't possibly be Christian, therefore couldn't possibly be someone that we have to obey.
Just a quick question. You said that the Anabaptist Papists release themselves from the just commands of a magistrate who they have these differences with. If the command is just and you're doing what's right, aren't you doing that just thing that the king was commanding, or not? Or abstaining from whatever unjust thing is the king is commanding you abstain from? Like, would they go out of their way intentionally to do something that maybe is biblically unjust because the king decrees that you know, let's say
the Anabaptists did.
So even if a totally pagan king just sort of happens upon some biblical precept and says, you know what, that is just,
you know, law of nature.
Right. Well, yeah. Right. Okay. And so they would intentionally, like, fly in the face of that.
I'm not going to say they were in the habit of doing that, but they did do it on occasion.
Okay. Interesting.
Are they confuted for the following reasons? First, because we're commanded to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man. Again, 1 Peter 2:13.
1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme.
Yeah, namely in all that they command us, if they be not contrary to God in his command. Otherwise, according to Acts 4:19, it's better to obey God than man.
Acts 4:19. But Peter and John answered and said unto them, whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God, judge ye.
So I think we have to consider here that even if you have an unlawful exercise, if they're telling you to do something just and legal, and that's important, you know, they're not telling you to do something where they're going to be able to trip you up on, you know, oh, you just broke some law, it's going to put you in, you know, in danger or whatever. There really is no reason not to do what you're being told to do, right? And I say that even if they are they themselves are total heathens, and it's very clear that they're hostile to true religion and so on. That doesn't release you from doing what's just and what's legal when they command you to do it. Now, the one thing, unless this were to counteract a moral duty, if they were to command you to do something just and legal, but not necessarily moral duty, and its purpose was to, you know, bring you, cause you to commit idolatry, for example, you couldn't do it. Right. See, you have to remember, I can do all of this in an area where it's my goods to give, but I don't ever have the right to do this in an area where it's God's goods to give, that I'm giving up. I don't have a right to give up God's goods. You know, people, and there are people who think, well, I'd rather sing the Psalms. But, you know, they're singing hymns here, and, you know, I don't want to make trouble. Well, you know, if this were something that was yours to give, that would be one thing. But you don't have the authority to allow anyone else to use hymns of human composition, right? And that holds anywhere in church or state.
Are you talking about like societal order, like, you know, like a speed limit or traffic law, stuff like that?
If they're telling you to do it, generally speaking, yes, you should do it.
But you don't do it for conscience sake, though, right? You do it for conscience sake to God, not because the magistrate's telling
you. Right, conscience sake to God, yeah. The issue is, when we talk about, are we obeying them as lawful magistrates? No. We're doing it because it is in itself just and legal.
For the public good. for your brethren.
That might be one reason. It may not be the only thing. Right, second, because the Christians, which were in Rome, were commanded by the apostles to subject themselves to the higher powers, that without exception of religion and piety, and even to that heathen, the Roman emperor, Romans 13:1.
Romans 13:1, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. For there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God.
Right, and although, you know, I deny that Paul is speaking particularly about the Roman government there, he is talking about the institution of authority. And so, you know, should the heathen government of Rome behave in this manner, they too would be then worthy recipients of the kind of subjection and honor that he's talking about there. Right? And that's the point. And even, you know, even in cases where they remain unlawful in their constitution or institution, the fact is, when they're telling you to do something just and legal, we have an obligation as Christians, as much as lies with us, to be at peace with all men. Right? We should seek to abide by those things because they are conducive to living quiet and peaceable lives. So we're not to go out and pick fights. You know. On the other hand, during the killing times, you know, the fight was brought to the Covenanters. They didn't really have a choice. They could either fight back or die, you know, without fighting. But they didn't have a choice in the matter, other than renounce, you know, the faith and yield some sort of passive obedience, I suppose, which would have basically would have made them all a bunch of pagans. Right, three, because the same apostle writing to Titus bids him exhort the Cretans as hearers to obey magistrates, what manner of ones soever they be, not only believing ones, but also those that are unbelieving, as then they were most of them. Titus 3:1.
Titus 3:1, put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready to every good work.
Right. And so again, you know, is there a benefit to a general compliance with a providential administration in things which are just and law legal? Yeah. Right? But if they try to turn these things into, or they demand of us, an acknowledgement of a legitimacy, well, now they've turned it into an entirely different proposition. And we can't yield that. Right? We can't. That's now we're yielding not what, you know, what is potentially Caesar's or what is mine to yield, even in the face of an unjust imposition. I mean, if somebody comes to you and puts a gun in your face and says, give me your money or your life, you can give them your money. Right, but if they say now bow down and worship, you know, some false god, you can't do that. You can't give that. You know, now I've moved from what belongs to me that I'm allowed to give up to save my life to something that I'm not allowed to give up to save my life. You know, I can't renounce the true religion. I can't worship a false god. I can't. You know, if they say blaspheme God, you know, I can't do that. Likewise, if they say you must acknowledge us as a lawful administration, no, I'm not going to do that. This is a bridge too far. Can't do that. That's why we don't vote. That's why we don't serve on juries. That's why we won't serve in the military. Take oaths under these people. Not because there's anything inherently wrong with any of those things. It's not inherently wrong for a Christian to be a magistrate. But when, in order to that, you're required to acknowledge legitimacy, a lawfulness where it clearly doesn't exist. That now you're being asked to give something you can't give. Before, because when the Apostle Paul was pursued for his life and charged with matters criminal, he appealed unto Caesar. Acts 25:10-11.
Acts 25:10-11. Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews, have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest? For if I be an offender, or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof they accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar.
Right. Do you have a right to appeal to an unjust or unlawful administration? Sure. Samuel Wiley pointed out in Two Sons of Oil, you know, if you're traveling in Mexico and you're robbed by banditti, they take, you know, $100, but the rules among the banditti say they can only take $80. Can you appeal to get the other $20 back to the chief of the banditti? Say, hey, you're bandits. Say they took more than they were allowed to take. Yeah, it's within your right. Are you acknowledging that's a lawful administration or exercise of authority? Not at all. Okay? What's Paul doing? Paul's doing exactly the same thing. He's not yielding, he's not acknowledging a lawfulness to this, as we'll see later. All right, 5, because the prophet Jeremiah did own the power of Zedekiah, who had turned aside to false worship and had despised the oath which he had made to the king of Babylon. Ezekiel 17:16-18 and Jeremiah 27:20.
Ezekiel 17:16-18. As I live, saith the Lord God, surely in the place where the king dwelleth that made him king, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he brake, even with him in the midst of Babylon he shall die. Either shall Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company make for him in the war by casting up mounts and building forts to cut off many persons, seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, when, lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape.
Jeremiah 27:20, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took not when he carried away captive Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from Jerusalem to Babylon, and all the nobles of Judah and Jerusalem.
So, again, you know, what is it that Jeremiah is owning? Well, he's, you know, Christianity is not calling us to insanity. I mean, we know that in certain cases, people actually have power, right? To ignore that is to ignore reality, to pretend like reality is not what it is. We're not being asked to do that. You know, Jeremiah recognizes that, and he's going to deal with that as it is. But again, you know, is he recognizing a legitimacy there, or is he simply recognizing the reality of what lies before him, that there is someone who has power, and great power even. You know, power enough to harm him and anyone else he wants to harm, in some respects. And so Jeremiah is not, you know, he hasn't surrendered rationality by being a believer. But he also isn't going to yield to Caesar what belongs to God. And he's certainly not going to acknowledge this as a legitimate exercise if it's not. Maybe a reality with which he has to deal, and he does. All right, question 3. Are ecclesiastical persons exempted from due obedience to the magistrate? And this is important, as I say, because Romanism has historically said that they're, you know, they're exempted from obedience to the magistrate. The answer to this, of course, is no. 1 Kings 2:35, 2 Peter 2, verses 1, 10, 11, and Jude 8 through 11.
1 Kings 2:35, and the king put Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, in his room over the host, and Zadok the priest did the king put in the room of Abithar.
2 Peter 2, verses 1 and 10 and 11. But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that brought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction.
Jude
8, their own 3.
And verses 10 and 11. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh and the lust of uncleanness, and despise government. Presumptuously are they, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignities, whereas angels, which are greater in power and might, bring not railing accusation against them before the Lord.
Yeah. Thus the papists do err, maintaining that the clergy, as they call them, and their goods are altogether free by the law of God from secular powers. It's for this reason, for example, that papists have lobbied and gotten an exemption so that if you say something to them in confession, it can't be used against you in a court of law. They use this privilege to... and they've been using it recently with all of the scandals regarding pedophiles in the church. They deny that the civil magistrate has any right to invade the church. They're going to take care of it. The magistrate has no authority or jurisdiction over them. Now, I think most Western governments are beginning to disagree with some of this, but this has been a long-standing demand and a long-standing assertion on the part of the Roman Church that they were exempted from this kind of obedience, and I guess they can behave however they want.
So in a Christian government, that crime would be punishable by both the church and the state, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
But they're confuted for the following reasons. First of all, the command of obedience is general and universal. Again, look at Romans 13:1.
Romans 13, verse 1, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be ordained, are ordained of God.
Yeah, there are no powers but of God. Right? Let every soul. Doesn't say, except, clergy, which is a misuse of a biblical word. The word clergy in the Bible, the word clergy refers to heritage. It means heritage. And in 1 Peter 5, it's clear that all of the people of God are his clergy. There's no clergy-lady distinction in the church. But based on this distinction, they set this entire class of people apart and declare them to be somehow exempted from something which Paul says is not possible, because every soul, when you've got a lawful authority, every soul is required to be subject to it. Right, not there's no exemption for the church when it comes to the civil ruler, when the civil ruler is in fact legit. All right. Second, because Paul acknowledges himself subject to the magistrate, Acts 25:9-11.
Acts 25:9-11. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, "Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?" Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar.
Yeah, so he doesn't... Paul's attitude is not that, he doesn't plead clerical exemption. Again, Paul is... He's making an appeal to the one who, in reality, can rectify, set right his situation. He's also doing it, I think, to get himself to Rome. So he can appeal all the way to the top. He wants to take the gospel to Caesar. Right, third, from the example of the priests who were subjected to their kings, 1 Kings 2:26.
1 Kings 2:26, and unto Abiathar the priest said the king, get thee to Anathoth unto thine own fields, for thou art worthy of death, but I will not at this time put thee to death, because thou bearest the ark of the Lord God before David my father, and because thou hast been afflicted in all wherein my father was afflicted.
So, this discussion is here because Romanism under Romanism, in every nation, the Pope had what we might call a fifth column. They had the Pope had an entire cadre of soldiers who were loyal to him rather than the nation in which they were stationed, and they were not subject to those laws, so they could do all kinds of things, and they did all kinds of things. There are a lot of horror stories that come out of the Reformation of what these people did, and a lot of it's because they were not subject to any kind of civil authority.
Aren't they Swiss, right? At least right now, his own private guards?
Swiss guards.
Mm-hmm.
That's who's taking... I'm not talking about Swiss guard, I'm talking about every priest, every cardinal, every bishop, every member of the clergy, what they would call the clergy, they don't believe that they're subject to the magistrate. So, if a priest molests a boy, or as a lot of these guys, dozens of boys, that priest is subject to Rome, not to any other civil authority. So that's their assertion. They some of these people, because of their position in the church, it's very hard. Just like if you have an ambassador from another country and they commit a crime, usually the most that country can do where they commit the crime is send them away. You can't prosecute them. Can't do anything. They are above the law of that land. They don't answer to the law of that land. That's the way the Pope's clergy has been treated, they've asserted that prerogative, and they've actually received that treatment in a lot of nations.
Is the idea of diplomatic immunity does that apply only to moral offense? To non-moral offenses, no.
In the way it works itself out in the modern world is it applies to all offenses. A diplomat from another country can kill someone, and you don't have the right without the permission of their government. You don't have the right to try them. You can expel them, can't try them. When they come over with diplomatic immunity, and this is, again, something very similar that Romanism is claiming, they come over, they have a diplomatic pouch, they can bring anything in that they want. And they're not allowed to even search it. It's treated like a piece of foreign soil. So every Romish cathedral in this country for example, is actually like an embassy of a foreign government. Wow. You know, Romanism is an insidious, horrific system. And its predatory behavior with respect to kids has only recently been unmasked. All right, the last question we're going to talk about, question four, has the Pope any power or jurisdiction over magistrates in their dominions or over any of their people? The answer is no. Revelation 13, 15 to 17.
Revelation 13, 15 through 17. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name.
Thus the papists do err, maintaining the Pope of Rome as Pope has full power by divine right over the whole world, as well in matters civil as ecclesiastical. And that is their assertion. They still believe that. And that is, in fact, the very thing which constitutes the papacy antichrist.
Do the papists agree with, or do they understand the mediatorial reign of Christ? Because if the Pope has control over the whole world, he is the vicar of Christ, right? So Christ must have complete mediatorial rule over the whole world.
Well, what they've done, in this, we're going to see this more when we get to the chapter of marriage. They have sacramentalized nature. They don't recognize. No, they don't. They actually don't. They don't recognize the distinction between God, the Creator, and Christ, the Mediator, that we're talking about. You know, that this idea that government in general is founded in nature and not in grace. Okay, they think everything is not just subject to the church, but that it only has its being as flowing from the church. They're confuted for the following reasons. First, because Christ expressly discharges his disciples from taking to themselves any such power or dominion, Matthew 20, 25-26, and Mark 10, 42-43.
Matthew 20, verses 25 and 26, But Jesus called them unto him and said, Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister.
Mark 10, 42 and 43, But Jesus called them to him and saith unto them, Ye know that they which are accounted to rule over the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and their great ones exercise authority upon them. But so shall it not among you, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister.
So it's not the province of the church then to exercise civil dominion. Second, because the kingdom of Christ is not of this world, John 18:36.
John 18:36. Jesus answered, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now is my kingdom not from hence.
And neither ought the Pope's kingdom to be of this world, who calls himself vicar of Christ. It's not, I mean, if he really is, but that, again, this is this is the thing that makes him stand against Christ and instead of Christ, makes him antichrist. That he does exactly what? We're told it doesn't pertain to the church to be the civil dominion, and yet Romanism is, by its own admission, an assertion of civil dominion. The third, because when the people would have made Christ king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone, John 6:15.
John 6:15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force, to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone.
Yeah, so he wasn't trying to exercise civil authority. This is the point. That was not how this was to be. Civil government is not, his purpose here is to establish his church, not to establish civil government. Civil government already exists. Fourth, because the Apostle Peter discharged this dominion, 1 Peter 5, 1 to 3.
1 Peter 5, verses 1 to 3. The elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the suffering of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock.
So Peter's not looking to exert this kind of dominion. He's not looking for this kind of overarching authority over society. Fifth, because it is never heard that any of the apostles did ever use any civil power or command or sat as judges in civil matters. They stood always to be judged by civil powers, as evident from the history of the Acts. And throughout Acts, we don't see them asserting that they had the prerogative of magistracy. The Bible's pretty clear, drawing a line between magistracy and ministry. They both have their respective realms. They both have their respective subjects, and they both have their respective powers. And they don't mix. We don't see them mixing it up in the book of Acts. Six, because God has put a difference between the government of the church and the civil government, and has given to each their own proper distinct officers, which is what I was just noting. Neither can one invade the other without very great sin. 2 Chronicles 19:8-11.
2 Chronicles 19:8-11. Moreover, in Jerusalem did Jehoshaphat set of the Levites and of the priests and of the chief of the fathers of Israel for the judgment of the Lord and for controversies when they returned to Jerusalem. And he charged them, saying, thus shall ye do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a perfect heart. And what cause soever shall come to you of your brethren that dwell in your cities, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and judgments, ye shall even warn them that they trespass not against the Lord. And so wrath come upon you, and upon your brethren, this do, and ye shall not trespass. And behold, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites shall be officers before you. Deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good.
Okay. And finally, because it's the mark of Antichrist to exalt himself above all that is called God. 2 Thessalonians 2:4.
2 Thessalonians 2:4, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God.
So again, what is it that makes the Pope Antichrist, the Antichrist? Well, it's really, he's turned the entire church project inside out. Asserted himself to be not simply the vicar of Christ, but he wants to assert his authority over all nations as well. Romanism, the rise of Romanism, was the demise of national churches, church states in the provinces and kingdoms. And with the Reformation, all of that was reversed. It brought an end to the rule and reign of Antichrist in that respect. All right, next time we will begin the discussion of the doctrine of marriage and divorce, which will take several weeks.